All right. So you're ready for a new edition of Blind Ambition. Today we have a great guest. We're going international. And you know what? I'm going to hand it off to Ingrid. Can you introduce yourself and tell about your company?
Hello, Jack. I'm really, really honored to be in your podcast. My name is Ingrid de Klerk, and I'm the Chief People Officer of Deliverect. And Deliverect is a SaaS unicorn with a base in Belgium, but now working all over the world. And we connect the delivery platforms like Uber Eats and Takeaway with restaurants, and to make sure that their operations run more efficiently, that they are more profitable, and in the end also that they thrive.
You know, it's interesting. Is there a growing tech scene and a startup scene in Belgium and Brussels or in Europe altogether? Because I can see a lot here in the US. How is it over there? Are you very unique in that respect?
We are a tiny, tiny country, Belgium. And so we're not even in Brussels, we're in Ghent. And in Ghent, so that is one of the cities in Flanders. And in Ghent, there is really a tech scene. And so in the meantime, we have grown in 4 years' time, we've grown from zero to 500 people, of which now are, I think, around 150 are in Ghent, in the headquarters, and all the rest are divided over our 14 different offices all over the world.
Well, that's crazy. Wait, so you started as a consultant, if I understand correctly, and now you're the chief people officer. So you went from zero to how many and how quickly did you do this?
It was from zero to 500 in 4 years' time.
How do you do that? Like that from the outside, right? That seems to be a lot. And, you know, my profession, I run a search firm, so I know what it's like to try to recruit and hire and retain. And it's hard. And then it's especially hard when you're trying to find tech talent, because like in your business, there's a lot of technologists, right? A lot of software engineers, software developers. Like, how were you able to find them? How did you bring them aboard? Like, do you have to go internationally, or is there enough in Ghent and Belgium and Europe to track from there?
That is a zillion questions at the same time. So I'll try to answer them how would they find them? And we first started looking here in Ghent. Yeah. And when we try to attract people, we don't only look at Ghent. When I look at the amount of nationalities that we have at Deliverect, and even the Ghent office, it's crazy. We have people from Uzbekistan, from Kazakhstan, from people from Madrid. It's a very, very international bunch of people. And so if you ask the question, how did we grow so fast? Yeah, roll up the sleeves and go for it. And I have to say, there were times when our growth was really exponential that it was quite messy. And now, I mean, we have the recruitment process a little bit better under control.
So
sometimes in the beginning we used agencies, and now no longer. Since May last year, we do our recruitment all in-house.
And when you started out doing it, was it hard to recruit because people never heard of your company, I imagine, because it's a startup, and usually you might have it in Silicon Valley or San Francisco, maybe New York. So is it more challenging to tell your story to get people to come aboard?
Yes and no. When we're talking the headquarters, our two of our four founders, they've launched a startup already a couple of years ago called Posios, and then it was sold to a Canadian company, Lightspeed, that later went to the stock exchange and had massive success. So in Belgium, Zhong Shu and Jan Hollet, they are a name. And so when recruiting tech talent here in Ghent, and so when we're talking about these two co-founders, that was really an asset.
So in other words, you were helped because of the prior success, so that when you're out recruiting, people would know about your company, know about the people affiliated with it. So it made it a little easier. And when you look for people, for tech startup, and if I understand it correctly, maybe also you could explain a little bit what the platform does, because I think it just connects you know, it's like Switzerland. It's agnostic that it offers the software for all sorts of restaurants that they could send out orders. Is that kind of sort of?
I think that is a beautiful comparison. Let me just describe it. So suppose you have a restaurant in downtown that also does delivery, or a dark kitchen. And so they would, as delivery platforms, they would have Uber Eats, Takeaway.com, Deliveroo. And so behind the counter earlier, they would have all these iPads where all the orders would be flowing in. And so they needed to type them in their own point of sale system, which of course, I mean, it takes time, it's inefficient, and mistakes happen. And Deliverect built a kind of integrator. So where that all the orders come, they go to the point of sale system, to the kitchen, to the, even some, in some cases also the back office. And so they make the entire handling a lot more easier, more profitable, more efficient. And of course, Corona was not a good time, but yeah, for our business, it was a good time.
Isn't that weird how things are? Like, you could have for so many people, oh my, this is the worst time ever. But then some companies, and a lot of, like, you know, the online companies thrive because now people didn't want to go to their homes. They just want to order online. So in a bizarre way, you were at the right place at the right time to make this happen.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And so what makes, I'm going to come back to an earlier question that you asked, is how do you guys attract talent? So, and now I'm taking a big step back. Huh? What we did with the four co-founders, because there are four co-founders, in a very early stage of the company, we've spent a lot of attention to elaborating our values. I think there were only five people in the company where we already thinking about what kind of company do we want to have? What is our vision on way of working? Okay? What kind of organizational structure do you want? What are our values? And we, with the founders, we came up to a kind of a number of principles around values, which we then shared with the entire company, being 15 people, not a lot. And instead of like dumping top down on their heads, we composed working groups for each of the elements in the way of working: organization design, goal setting and monitoring, role setting and evolution, everything that had to do with communication, feedback mechanisms, conflict mechanisms, and that kind of thing. And then eventually also culture, values, communication. And these working groups helped elaborate the basic principles. And that has been very crucial in spreading the word and spreading the vibe, because they helped build it. And if there's a lot of newcomers coming in, the entire company who has helped elaborating the principles transferred them also to the newcomers, and who then transferred it to the newcomers and to the newcomers.
So it makes sense that this way you kind of define your corporate culture, so that when people come in, first principles, they you know, feel comfortable. Hey, they self-select to come to the company because they like your values and what you're doing. And then it kind of just fulfills itself. But when it first starts, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people always see unicorn status, like, wow, you're billion plus within only a few years. You know, what's it like when you start out, like you said, like just a few people? I mean, mm-hmm. did you feel that it's just going to grow exponentially, or like every day was nervous? Hey, is this going to work? Is that technology going to work? Can we get, you know, can we make this happen? Like, what's it feel like to be in that position?
It was thrilling. It was so exciting. And I'm come back to what I said earlier. Some of the founders already had a scale up and sold it. And so, I mean, they'd gone through the adventure. And our CEO was like so really persuaded that this was going to go massive. I remember the first time that he talked to me about the new venture, he said, Ingrid, this is going to go great. This is going to go massive all over the world. And he was really, really certain of it because he found it was, in fact, it was a hole in the market.
So I wonder, is it a big difference if like you have a place, you know, that has been successful, you know, like people who were successful before, does that kind of make it easier for you and everyone else? Because like, oh, they've done it, they'll do it again. As opposed to if, let's say there were just four people who weren't founders, never start a company, and then you're doing it from scratch. Do you think it would have been different?
I think it's easier. I mean, of course, yeah. they've banged their head against the wall with a couple of mistakes, I guess. And so if they learned about, I think it goes faster. But of and it's not because you've done it before that, that the second your second venture is a guaranteed success. But of course they've learned a couple of things.
So when you started out, would they what would you hire first? Do you go after the software developers, you know, the software engineers, or how does, from your perspective as a chief people officer and, you know, talent acquisition, like, how do you even get it started? Who do you go to first? How do you do it? How do you get people bored? How do you sell them on it?
I mean, so the two of the four co-founders are, in fact, they have a software background. I mean, they're software engineers. Mm-hmm. So I think at the beginning, they started coding themselves. And of course, then the first hires were software people to help build the platform. And then later on, sales.
And then after that, just slowly... just find what the needs are and scale up and scale up and keep growing it.
Yeah, yeah. And so we went into other companies quite fast. Yeah, so that is also a difference between a first time startup and a second. I think because they had this experience of going global earlier. So I think this time they also went global a lot earlier.
What was, from your vantage point, like, what was the hardest part? Was it just trying to recruit people, retain people, pay them well to compete with Silicon Valley?
Yeah, of course, Ghent is not Silicon Valley. That's an advantage. What I always say, because I've been working with startups a lot, you can't pay in startups, you can't offer the same wages that you're offering in Silicon Valley. And also you shouldn't. If you want to attract people that are fit for startups, you want people who are willing to take that risk, to come on board, and maybe the company goes bust after a couple of years, but they don't matter. I mean, I always say that if we want to recruit people who have a passion for building, and so who get that, who want to wake up every morning and say, I want to help build this company. And not as when this is something secure, and of course wages, I think it is a necessary element, but it is not a motivator in a company in a startup.
That's interesting. So when you interview people, it sounds like you're really feeling them out. Do they embrace this kind of environment, this kind of culture, that they really buy into it? And mm-hmm. if not, you maybe kind of take a pass on them, right? You have to really, I guess, that's part of the whole interview process.
Yeah. If you see in the interview process that people are looking for stability and security, and for clear guidance, then you go like, no, there is a lot of ambiguity in a startup, and so people have to be able to live with that ambiguity. Now, I mean, we're 500. Now we do have more clear roles, yeah. And we do have. A little bit of levels. I'm seeing a little bit of levels, because at the start, our vision was to have multifunctional teams, as much self-managing as possible. And there, I learned a thing or two because I used that self-management technique in other companies, and what I learned at the Liverect is that when you're scaling so fast, self-management is not possible yet, because there is self-management is only possible when the playing field is clear, and within that playing field you can give people a lot of liberty and autonomy and ownership, But we were growing so fast that it was also difficult to have a clear playing field. And this year, because I got, we have an Ask Me Anything session once a month, or once every 2 months, where employees can ask all kind of questions to the executive team. And so I got a question that said, Ingrid, where is this thing with self-management? I mean, we do have hierarchy now. And I said, yes, indeed, we do have hierarchy. First of all, when you're 500, you can't have a flat organization design. That's no longer possible. Secondly, and then this explanation that I gave to you just now is, I mean, if you're growing so fast, I mean, it's impossible because the playing field is not clear. But this year, I want to start experimenting with self-managing teams again. We've just created a new department, which is called the Strategy and Ops Cell. And there are four people in there, or maybe soon five. And I don't want a head. I want them to self-organize. So now we're starting to experiment with self-managing it again.
So in addition to self-management, and before you joined, you had and I think you still have a management consulting company geared towards human resources. Are there other types of strategies or processes that you put in place the way you were just talking about with this one?
What I've just launched is a new program that we baptized G Square. And what is G Square standing for is like achieving extraordinary business growth through growing our people. So business growth, people growth, G Square. And we want to develop a program where we very deliberately focus on people growth, on personal growth and career path. Because from a deep belief that if you grow your people, your business will grow. And I've
that
just introduced it to the entire organization.
So how do you do that? Like, what are the nuts and bolts of that? Is that upskilling, training, continuing education? How does that work?
Amongst others, mentorship. So there is a whole array of support that we will put in place in order to make that growth possible. And I told the company, I said, but the most important part is to develop a strong culture of feedback. Because if I develop my if I list my personal learning goals and I share them with you, and we are working together, if you give me feedback on what you see, I will grow so much faster than when it only can only come from my head. And I don't know what about in your countries, but in my country, and in fact, I see it all over the Livrek, giving each other that honest, open, and direct feedback is still difficult. Huh?
See, I like that process that you're doing, because I see here in the U.S., big challenges. People feel very disengaged. Do you have like the same thing there in Europe, where quiet quitting, acting your wage, rage applying to jobs? I'm trying to think like all those different things where the undercurrent is like people aren't happy. They just feel overlooked. And then what happens, they just, you know, despite whatever kind of catchphrase they use, it's like they're just coasting, because not because they're trying to be lazy. It's just they don't feel like they don't feel engaged with what's going on. And do you think it's because maybe the companies don't go for their feedback? They don't give them training. They don't kind of ask them, how are you doing today? Is that kind of like a big difference you notice?
What I think was when you look at elements that cause burnout and maybe also quiet quitting, is that an important element is ownership. If people feel if they don't have the feeling that they contribute to something and that they have something that they can, again, I'm using the word playing field, that within that playing field that they can have authority and freedom, I mean, I think they easily disengage. And that is why in what the Livrek ownership is one of our core values.
And does that, have you noticed, does that help with retention and recruiting new people when people like, when they hear about, you know, your I guess it's called like almost philosophies in terms of, you know, philosophical, you know, thought process and how to, you know, help people. Does that help in terms of the recruiting and retention? Because it makes people feel part of the organization. You know, they're heard, they'll get feedback, they'll learn from it. Have you noticed that that really like makes a difference and helps out compared to like other companies that you see just constant, like a turnstile of people coming and going, coming and going?
I hope so. I think so. Can I, I'm going to build on that creative problem solving framework that I talked about. We also use an, a personality instrument that is called foresight. And foresight gives you an idea where you, as a person, have an inborn preference for each of the four phases that I talked about. And knowing your inborn preference, again, helps in understanding yourself, and knowing which of the phases you tend to skip, but also in collaboration. And that has proven a really, really valuable instrument. Because I'm going to give you my example. I'm someone who needs, I'm going to ask you a ton of questions, the clarifying phase, and then I rush into implementation. I'm very bad at depth and detail. I know that for myself. I know that is a phase that I tend to skip. But if I'm working together with someone who has a high preference for ideation, and that person will say, we can also do this, we can also do that, and I'll go like, oh my God damn it, no, let's run, we already have one solution, let's go for it. So you make the working in a team, you can discuss behavior in a much more constructive way. You're shooting the ball and not the man. So if you're talking of what methodologies have you applied at DeliverAct, in DeliverAct, everybody goes through this personality instrument, which means that we use this language also to describe what is working well, what is not working well, or both from a personality perspective as from a process perspective. Let me give you an example. Our CEO has a high preference on ideating. And so that means that in any phase of the project, he'll come up and say, you know, guys, what we can still do, what we can also do. And even a CEO tells you, what we could also do, that sounds much more like an order than like a suggestion. But it's sometimes very disruptive. And so everybody working with our CEO knows that they have to ask him, Zong, is this an idea or do you actually want me to do it? And then Zong says, oh, no, it's just an idea. See? And so we use this instrument both for a phase and for a personality type.
That I like that. That's really interesting because the constant conversations, these open and honest conversations help out. And even that last piece, what you mentioned, because let's say here in the US, you would have the CEO say something, you're just going to assume, okay, that's what he or she wants, let's jump on it and not maybe push back and say, wait, is that you're saying we got to do this now, or it's just a nice to have, or maybe we could do this later, and to have that ongoing dialogue. And I imagine when you have this ongoing dialogue, it brings the employee, the worker into it because they feel like, oh, I'm part of it. I'm not being told to do X and Y and, you know, push down to me. I'm kind of an active participant in what's going on, and I could ask questions and I could be involved, which makes people more engaged. And then when you're more engaged, you're going to work harder, smarter, better, and because you're going to feel appreciated, right? So it's a self-fulfilling thing to make the whole workplace better.
Yeah, and as a leader, I think it's from our CEO, I think it's really strong to openly share. These are my strengths and these are my pitfalls. Right? We had a product management offsite not so long ago, and our CEO openly shared, these are my strengths, these are my pitfalls. This works in collaborating with me, and that is beautiful. Right? That it demands a certain vulnerability of the leader, but it's so strong.
You're making sure you're making everybody happy on every level. So like to be, because you have to be competitive, right? Because like you're hiring a lot of people who are in demand, you know, marketers, techies, all this kind of stuff. So I guess you have to do, you know, all these things and then some.
Yeah, you know what? It's not just if you want to say how do you keep your people engaged. It's not just one thing. It's a whole lot of things. When I talk about culture, I often say I compare culture to a campfire. Mm-hmm. You might have the most beautiful campfire. If you don't put on a log from time to time, your fire dies. And so we have to think about a whole array of logs. And one of the important log is a sufficient pay. I mean, you don't have to be stupid about it. I mean, a salary is important. But it's also culture. It's how you collaborate, how you celebrate, how you learn. These are all the different logs, and it's not just one thing. That won't cut it.
See, I do notice that for retention, it really helps if you can keep learning and growing. I find out the people who, to go back to like the quiet quitting, acting your wage, I think a lot of it is because they just hit the ceiling mm-hmm. and their bosses, their supervisors, their HR people, no one is reaching out to them to say, hey, here's what you could do next. Here's how you can grow. So then they feel I can't grow. And if you can't grow, then all of a sudden you just lose that passion, right? You just like, I'm stuck. And then I'm going to just, you know, look at the internet all day. I'm going to look for jobs. I'm going to just mentally check out. So it's like, so you want to have your people kind of engaged, empowered to take control over their career, to interact with their bosses, their peers, to accept feedback, to get constructive criticism. So it's like, you're really enmeshed in it. So you feel you're part of something, right?
Yeah. And I think career path is needs to come from both sides. I mean, people should not just wait on until their career is offered to them on a silver platter. Start looking around in a company. Where are areas where you say like, that is something that I might want to learn. Look at the vacancies. Suppose that you say, I'm in sales and I have an interest in marketing. So, I mean, there's so many online courses now. Start learning something at home, after your hours, of course, to show your interest and your dedication. It should not all come from top down.
Does it matter if it's remote or in office when you talk about culture?
In Corona times, it wasn't easy. And still, I think we managed to keep the company culture. And an important element there is that we build an onboarding course, which now takes a week. So now if a new person comes on board, they go through an online self-paced and also assisted onboarding course, where we talk about the companies, the story of origin, the culture, the products, etc., etc. And I think I've not done it because I'm with the company a long time, but when people get out of that course, they are completely pumped up. So I think my colleagues of the learning and development department have done a fantastic job in building it.
And the reason I was asking, because like here in the States, there's still this fight between getting people back to the office. You know, you have this group, a lot of Wall Street firms, a lot of others just trying to push them back. And a lot of others say, no, I have a better balance of work and life. And this, I just wonder for the remote people, and it's very touchy because everyone is very like opinionated on one side or the other for the most part. But the ones, if you're at home, is it harder to do those feedback and, you know, some of the things you're talking about, or through videos and Zooms and everything else, it doesn't matter. You could still retain that culture.
You can still do it because in Corona times, this group feedback sessions that I talked about, we did them online. And so we used Mural, an online video, an online platform where people were writing post-its with the feedback, and it worked. And it's not the same. life, it's so much stronger, eh? Because you see so much more of the nonverbal elements, and yeah, it's different. I think it's really important to come to the office regularly, because you transfer all the vibes and the culture and the initiatives and the collaboration, and so much more than online. And also, I don't think that we should be back to a 5 days a week at work at the office policy. Absolutely not.
So even when you're in the office, maybe 4 days a week, 3 days a week, that kind of thing?
I'm 3 to 4 days a week. And depending, I think some of the developer functions are a little less, because they prefer to have the to be able to concentrate. But we asked all of our collaborators to come back to the office a couple of days a week.
See, I think that makes sense, because especially for young people who are starting out their careers, you know, if you're starting out, you know, you graduate from college and now you're in your apartment or you move back home or whatever it may be, and like you don't get the vibe of what's going on in the office. Also, from a social aspect, this might sound silly, but I think it's important. From a social aspect, you want to build a network, you want to meet new people, you want to kind of see what's going on. And if you're just at home, even with a video, it'd be hard to miss it. Like for that cohort, I would almost, you know, say, hey, you probably should go in there, even, you know, at least three, maybe 4 days a week. So this way you kind of really see what's going on. Then you make, you know, because like you're young, you maybe you lost, you know, your friends go away. So like it's easy to feel isolated and alone. And that's not really good for your mental health. So if you're kind of in there building people, does that make sense? Because a lot of people don't subscribe to that. A lot of people are nope, just at home all the time.
No, I think that I think some of the people underestimate the mental health element. Because sometimes when you're all the time at home, you feel like in a cocoon. Is that proper English?
Absolutely. You're in a cocoon. You're by yourself. Cocoon. You're isolated.
And you only observe that it's a cocoon once you're out of it. And so it might make you more anxious to get into social connection or to have a relationship giving that feedback. But we're talking about learning. If you're in the office and you meet someone from another department, you can ask a proper quicker question. Anna, can you tell me about da, 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 da. If you're at home, that has to be a meeting. You have to like deliberately put in a meeting. It's not spontaneous. Mm-hmm. So that element of learning and cross-pollination, and it's so much stronger when you come to the office.
Let me ask you just one last question before we head out. In terms of like the next step for the company, for yourself, where do you see this going? How big can it get? How large? How many countries? What's the game plan?
I think we're only starting.
So this is just beginning. So there's a lot.
Yeah, the vision is big. In fact, the vision has, we want to make the restaurants and the food sector thrive. That is the overall mission. So there is a lot to do there.
There are a lot of restaurants, right? A lot of restaurants, a lot of food places. Take that technology and use it for other things too?
Yeah.
Outside of the restaurant and food industry, or that's way, you know, you have enough to do for now?
I think we have enough to do for that, but that will be really innovation. So take the platform and see how can we use that in another sector.
That's great.
I think when the founders get bored, so then they can think about that next venture. So using this platform in another sector.
Cool. You know what? All right. I lied. I have one more question. What would you say to people who either were laid off, worried about losing their job, you know, what to do in terms of how to find something new or how to have a mental construct of like how to get through this without, because it is tough. We all know that when you're looking for a job, it hurts your self-esteem, you know, your self-confidence, especially if you're in between roles. Do you have any suggestions for people who are looking, who have, you know, need to find a new job, what they should do?
Yes. What I often see when people are looking for a job, they look for a function right away. I want to be I want to be marketing specialist. What I often advise is stop, take a step back, list, first of all, what are your personality characteristics? What are you good at? What is your professional knowledge? That is one area. Second area is what motivates you? What makes you tick? Because the one is not necessarily the other. It's not because you can do it that you love doing it. And the third element is what values are important for you. And then only afterwards you try combining the knowledge, the motivation, and the values. And then you start looking for a job. And don't rush for a function title right away. First, look into the individual elements and the components of what you like, what you love, what you can do, because then you cast your net much wider.
Well, that's really great advice. I love that advice, because what you're saying, most people will just say, I'm an accountant, so now I'm going to look for an accounting job. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe take a step back, take a deep breath, give it some thought. What am I good? Almost like a Venn diagram, right? What am I good at? Yeah. You know, what are my skills? Can I make the money I want to make? You know, and then you find that intersection and say, okay, you know what? Maybe I won't be an accountant, but it transfers over to, and then you can find things that, you know, make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I've seen is that when you do that kind of exercise, that is also a moment where you process the loss. And so the loss of the function and so on, because there is always some grief. And taking the time to do that exercise very consciously and deliberately helps you also process the transition.
That's fantastic. So this is great. I really appreciate you taking the time. I think this was really illuminating. I love that you have a really structured, you put a lot of thought and effort into, you know, how to make the lives better of the people who work at your company. And I think more companies should do that as well. And I think that would make a big difference. Mm-hmm. If they did kind of adopt a lot of your, you know, thoughts and practices, because for sure, I tell you here, I don't know really so much what's going on here, but I can tell you without any doubt, here in the US, everybody's angry. Everyone's like anxious. Everyone is stressful. And I'm not exaggerating. It really is. And a lot has to do with work. And a lot has to do with layoffs. A lot has to do with worried about the economy, high inflation. And if they don't attend to it, like what you're trying to do, it just makes it worse. So I think a lot of what you're saying will resonate with people. And hopefully, you know, folks here, you know, in the US, you know, will hear about it and think about it, and maybe give them thoughts that, hey, we should maybe implement this kind of process. We could implement this, you know, a radical candor or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. to really try to focus on our employees and make their lives better.
Mm-hmm. I hope that I've been able to give some inspiration.
Yes. Well, thank you so much.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.